species. But now a complaint has been filed against the ship's doctor, accusing her of an ethical violation of medicine. Dr. Rebecca Gompertz has appeared on Portuguese television, explaining how some drugs, like the treated cold, can actually trigger an abortion.
Germany's been debating a controversy of its own, why one in five Germans would like to see the Berlin Wall back. 14 years on and a trillion euros later, there's still dissatisfaction with reunification. Many Germans from the West complain they've simply footed the bill, while Easterners are unhappy with low wages and too few jobs. And according to the survey, the old stereotypes still exist. Westerners are apparently know-it-alls, while Easterners are born whiners.
Europe unzipped.
And now on to our other main stories. Russian President Vladimir Putin has been under pressure to explain the confusing and bloody end to the school siege in Beslan. But a request by Dutch Foreign Minister Ben Bot on behalf of the European Union for more information was met with a furious response from the Kremlin. Russian officials don't understand why they should offer explanations, while other countries who've been victims of terrorist attacks don't. So has the rebuke from Moscow done serious damage to EU-Russia relations? I asked Martha Lippmann from the Carnegie Institute.
I think this is what is expected of the world, both by the government here and by the majority of the public, is compassion, condolences. It is almost universally believed that what happened in Russia is a barbarous act. However, any criticism, any questioning of the government policy, especially coming from the outside, is disapproved by both the government and the people. Critical opinion is received with suspicion and fury by the government and President Putin. The public may be more tolerant towards some criticism coming from the inside, but not from the outside.
Do you believe that the European Union almost overestimated the state of its diplomatic relations with Russia when it went into this affair, very sensitive matter?
Well, I'm not sure it...
Y terminamos contándoles que en la Vuelta Ciclista a España comienza hoy la montaña en la novena etapa.
Will adultery become illegal in Turkey?
Hence, all kinds of personal freedom to criminalize adultery by state and by law. But moreover, there's a direct link between adultery and honor crimes, because especially in eastern and southern eastern parts of Turkey, women and girls are being killed because they are committing adultery.
Also inside Europe, will the Beslan tragedy fuel yet more conflict?
Fears that cheaper booze will lead the Swedes astray. And ladies, hold on tight to those handbags. Those stories and more coming up in the program.
The Russian authorities moved swiftly to fight against separatism and terrorism. A $10 million reward was offered for information leading to the killing or capture of Chechen separatist leaders. And Moscow set up plan to launch preemptive strikes on terrorist bases in any region of the world. Western governments didn't get off lightly either. The Russian foreign minister accused London and Washington of double standards by granting asylum to Chechen separatists, saying the moves weakened global anti-terror efforts. But is President Putin simply trying to divert international attention from the war in Chechnya? I put that question to Anna Neistat of Human Rights Watch.
Absolutely, and that's quite typical. The current conflict in Chechnya is now in its fifth year. Over these years, our organization and other human rights activists, as well as the media, have been reporting egregious human rights violations, which continue up to date. Federal sources in Chechnya are responsible for numerous disappearances, summer executions, torture, and looting. Obviously, the other side is responsible for human rights violations as well. But the problem is that the Russian government, at least over the last 2 years, is trying to pretend that the situation has normalized. It's claiming that the conflict is winding down. Instead of taking some real measures to address this problem, it's just trying to create this image of normalization.
Is there any evidence that Russian security forces have cracked down even further in Chechnya since this school massacre?
It's really hard to say at this point, but I think we should absolutely expect further crackdown. That's what happened after much smaller scale attacks. Unfortunately, these attacks are way too often targeted against civilians. The problem is that no one can possibly challenge that Russia's right to conduct an anti-terrorist operation in Chechnya or in any other part of Russia. The problem is that its operation in Chechnya is abusive and absolutely indiscriminate.
But doesn't the school siege, which targeted children, and the fact that women are participating more and more in such attacks, indicate the sheer desperation of these separatists? And surely crackdowns will simply fuel that desperation.
I think the most important thing here is that desperation or not, nothing on earth can justify this egregious crime. On the other hand, indeed, for the purposes of the security of its own people, Russian government should start thinking very, very carefully about what it does in Chechnya. And once again, instead of trying to persuade everybody that the situation has normalized and taking some political measures such as conducting flawed referendums and elections, it should indeed curb abuses by its forces, try establishing meaningful accountability process, bringing perpetrators to justice, provide those living in Chechnya and the returning refugees and internally displaced with reasonable security guarantees, and most importantly, allow access to Chechnya for outside observers, be it the media or international observers, because as of now, Chechnya is completely closed from outside scrutiny, and Russia and the world just have very little information on what's really going on there.
On Thursday, the Kremlin announced a shake-up of security forces in the North Caucasus in order to prevent further attacks. Are you worried that human rights are going to be sacrificed even further in the name of national security?
Nowadays, human rights are being sacrificed in the name of security all over the world. And these days, Russia is clearly backsliding from democracy in almost every sphere of life. When you look at what's happening with the political opposition, the media, non-governmental organizations, sure enough, any measures that the Russian government is going to take are unfortunately very likely to present certain limitations on human rights rather than just address the problems with security forces and security in Russia in general.
Many grieving parents in Beslan say they're prepared to avenge the deaths of family members. How close are we to seeing an all-out civil war in the Caucasus?
I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but I do fear that the attack can fuel the old conflict between Ingushetia and North Ossetia. This conflict has ended 10 years ago, but on the other hand, there's a lot of tension between Ossetia and Ingush. Russian government's responsibility to prevent any ethnic clashes that may happen in North Ossetia and in Ingushetia. And as of now, I haven't seen much effort to on this particular effort.
Up until now, the international community has been prepared to allow President Putin to deal with the Chechnya conflict as a domestic issue. Could Beslan be the turning point? Could it force perhaps the UN to take a more active role in brokering a solution?
I definitely hope that the international community would now take a stronger stand on Chechnya. And in addition to supporting Russia in its fight against terror and condemning terrorist attacks in Russia, it would also take a closer look at what's going on in Chechnya and how Russia conducts this anti-terrorist operation, because I think these two things are unfortunately closely related. I certainly hope that European Union and the United States and hopefully the United Nations would stop pretending that the situation in Chechnya has normalized.
And yet the Kremlin says the US and UK are guilty of double standards because they've offered asylum to Chechen leaders. And yet, along with London and Washington, Moscow has been at the forefront of the so-called war against terror. Are we seeing cracks in the coalition here, or simply different definitions of what constitutes a terrorist?
To be honest, I was a little surprised by the statement, you know, that implied that the United States and is now inviting terrorists. My feeling was that President Putin now has to have on the international support in his war against terror. At the same time, I think there is just one thing that the Russian government does not want to understand and accept, that a certain Western countries fighting terrorists, still trying to abide by international and local laws, and including the laws that govern the issue of asylum. And this is not to say that Great Britain or United States aren't responsible for human rights violations when it comes to conducting terrorism. But at the same time, this particular issue is being governed by certain laws and regulations. And this is something Russian government does not want to buy, probably because for Russia, the idea that human rights are effectively guaranteed by the existing law is still a little alien.
And a nice start of Human Rights Watch. Are you faithful to your wife or husband?
Well, most people would probably answer,
it's none of your business, to such a question. But the Turkish government is saying it is our business. Ankara is planning to introduce legislation to make adultery illegal, saying it will strengthen the family unit. But liberals and women's groups have expressed their anger at the proposal, describing it as an outrageous intrusion into people's private lives. And the measure has also raised eyebrows at the European Union, which Turkey is hoping to join. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul on how the issue is dividing the country.
A century ago, the Galata district of Istanbul was home to the city's Italian community of traders and merchants. Today, it is where one of the largest state-controlled brothels can be found. Business here is brisk, with groups of men coming and going. Hats at their hands, and you'll see a great many wedding rings. But such infidelities may well become a thing of the past, if the Turkish Prime Minister has his way. A Turkish news bulletin announcing the government's plans to criminalize adultery with penalties of up to a year in jail. The proposal has taken the country by surprise. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been touring the country's media outlets, advocating his new policy. It is of national importance.
As long as our family institution is strong, then our nation is strong. Where the family structure is harmed, those nations, those countries are destined to collapse. The family needs to be protected. If a wife or a husband cheats on their partner, then they will be punished.
Prime Minister Erdogan claims he's introducing the law as a result of appeals from women. But not all women seem to share his concerns. In this Women's Rights Center, discussions are underway on what their next move should be to stop the legislation. Civil rights organizations have been outraged with the new law. Campaigner Pinar Ilkarajan says that in the past, women were victimized by a previous law criminalizing adultery, which was repealed only 8 years ago. She says this is a direct attack against all women, married or not.
It is against all kinds of personal freedom to criminalize adultery by state and by law. But moreover, there's a direct link between adultery and honor crimes, because especially in eastern and southern eastern parts of Turkey, women and girls are being killed because they are committing adultery. So if this law passes, it will send a signal to the society that even the state is actually criminalizing adultery. And the thing is, they're saying it will be equality. The women and men who are committing adultery will receive equal sentences. But this is a lie. The truth is, when it comes to real adultery situations, women are being killed, whereas even if the man commits adultery, a lot of the women are not in a situation not even to divorce him because they're economically and socially dependent on their husband.
Seems Square is the heart of Istanbul's entertainment district, with its cinemas, bars and restaurants. The meet for the young and courting couples. Here there appears overwhelming by both men and women to the government's proposal.
Let people do whatever they want.
Why? Well, I mean, the government say that they're protecting the family.
It's not up to the government to protect any family. It's the family members who are responsible for the protection.
That's what I think.
Of course, it's a bit thing for the government to enter our bedrooms and talk about our sex lives.
But a few hundred meters from Taksim is a different story. In the Pala Basra district, the faithful are going to prayer. This is one of the poorest districts of the city. Many who live here have recently migrated from the countryside. Support for the government is strong, and there appears to be equally strong support for criminalizing adultery.
There should be a solution to the crime of adultery. We all have children and families. The crime of adultery should be punished accordingly. If I personally commit it, I should be punished as well. Turkey is collapsing morally. They should find a solution to this. They find solutions for everything. They find a solution to this as well. People who commit adultery should get fined or even 10 years in jail so that they can't do it again.
The ruling AK Party derives much of its support from religious and conservative voters. And the government is facing mounting pressure from them for more policies like criminalizing adultery. But Ankara's stance on adultery is already drawing mounting criticism, both from home and abroad. The spokesman for the European Union has warned that criminalizing adultery could affect Turkey's EU membership bid. However, Prime Minister Erdogan appears unmoved, suggesting that Europe should consider adopting similar legislation. Dorian Jones, DW Radio, Istanbul.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Bei einer Sondersendung der Deutschen Welle und des MDR am 3. Oktober in Erfurt. Schreiben Sie uns Ihre Geschichte an Deutsche Welle, unter uns gesagt 53110 Bonn. Die E-Mail-Adresse lautet radio@dw-world.de unter dem Stichwort 3. Oktober. Wir freuen uns auf Sie.
Also schreiben Sie uns Ihre
Let's hear from Evelyn Herfkens, who is in charge of the Campaign for the Millennium Development Goals at the UN and former Dutch Minister for Development. Ms. Herfkens addressed members of civil society at their annual meeting at UN headquarters this week. She told them they had a big role to play in convincing their governments to meet the target of 0.7% GDP for official donor assistance.
These goals have transformed the face of global development cooperation. There has been unprecedented coordinated action in the multilateral system, in the wider donor community, within developing country, and most importantly, mobilization far beyond governments by civil societies, among parliamentarians, faith-based organizations, local authorities, etc. So in the real world, country after country, everywhere, it is in fact civil society that spurred this action and are making this happen. And the real problem is, and I've been in government, so I can say so, the government is beautiful speeches and beautiful promises. And then they take the plane back from New York to Rome or wherever to business as usual. So get the message out to your own politicians. Politicians, you better act now, otherwise you will lose votes. 34 years ago, rich countries agreed to do 0.7. For 30 years, it was only 43 countries in Northern Europe. But the Millennium Declaration and the goals have spurred action. And by now, apart from Sweden, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, the usual suspects, Luxembourg has surpassed 0.7. Five other countries have promised to do so. Well, it is fast. It's been. Our check cannot still be in the mail. routine. If you come from these countries, please go home and mobilize in order to monitor that you actually have annual increases towards achieving that date.
That was Evelyn Herfkens in charge of the campaign for the UN Millennium Development Goals. She was addressing members of the non-governmental organizations at their annual meeting at UN headquarters.
The International Criminal Court this week has opened its first session, considering two cases from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda. Here again is Lena Polo with UN Radio's report.
The International Criminal Court is holding this week its first session by its member states in The Hague, or the Assembly of States Parties, or ASP as it is known. The court came into force on July 1, 2002, to try war crimes that took place since that date. To date, it has taken up two investigations in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and in Uganda. The Netherlands has announced a first pledge to the trust fund for victims of 100,000 euros. I spoke earlier with the public advisor to the prosecutor, Chris Palmy, on developments at the week-long session.
This is a very important meeting. The state parties are the member states of the court. They are the owners of the court. They have elected the second deputy prosecutor of the court, deputy to the prosecutor, Luis Moreno Campo. And they've taken a number of other decisions. They have had discussions on the crime of aggression, which may be included in the jurisdiction of the court at a later time.
What would that be? What is the crime of aggression? Can you define it?
Essentially, it's what in the Nuremberg trial was called the crime of waging war, starting a war.
Now, the United States, which is not a member, how does that affect the workings of the court?
Well, this is an issue that don't really affect us, that we don't really talk about, because we serve the member states, the states' parties. But the prosecutor has said on a number of times that he expects that over time, all states on earth will become members of the court, although at the moment that is something which could take some years.
What is the number of signatories at this time?
The number of signatories is 139, but the member states, the states parties are 94. That's the number of states that have ratified the Rome Statute in their national parliament.
I know that the case in DRC was announced in June and the investigation in DRC and the other one in Uganda was in July, but can you just briefly describe what these two investigations imply?
Yes. On the 21st of June, the prosecutor announced the opening of an investigation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, an estimated 5,000 to 8,000 unlawful killings have been committed since the 1st of July 2002, which was the date when the jurisdiction of the court began, when the court was established. And on the 28th of July, the prosecutor announced the opening of an investigation in northern Uganda. In northern Uganda, there's been a civil war going on for 18 years, but since July 2002, again, in our jurisdiction, came into force, there have been widespread and systematic attacks or allegations of widespread and systematic attacks against the civilian population, including abduction of thousands of girls and boys.
Now, these cases, were these taken up by your prosecutor, or how were they brought to the attention of the court, and how did the court decide to take up these investigations?
Well, last summer, shortly after the prosecutor took office, he decided to open a preliminary analysis of the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And in March this year, the Congo formally referred the situation in its entire territory to the prosecutor. The Uganda case came to the ICC directly by a referral by Uganda. In December 2003, the Uganda referred the situation in the north of the country to the court. And that was the point when the preliminary analysis for Uganda began.
That was Chris Palmy, public information advisor for the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court on the line from The Hague, Netherlands, where the Assembly of States Parties is holding its first session in that country. The court's prosecutor is Luis Moreno Ocampo from Argentina, and this week the States Parties elected a deputy prosecutor, Satu Bensouda from the Gambia, for a 9-year term.
Before we go, here's our bulletin of news from the developing world. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he is encouraged by the latest peace talks between India and Pakistan. The two neighbors agreed on an array of measures to promote peace in South Asia, but remained far apart on their key dispute, the future of Kashmir, which both nations hold in part, but claim in full. Indian Foreign Minister Natwar Singh and his Pakistani counterpart Khurshid Mohammad Kasuri agreed to extend a ceasefire in force along a military line separating their armies in Kashmir. Ugandan police stormed a government building.